Every day they played around the Mayflower as she lay at anchor at Provincetown. Like the little fleets of dolphins, she must have passed 10 weeks before along the coast of Devon in England.
Those creatures that looked like dolphins, they were actually pilot whales, or blackfish, as the Mayflower pilgrims would come to call them. Historian Nick Bunker writes that to the pilgrims, the blackfish were familiar in their shape, but unfamiliar in their abundance.
There were so many whales that Jones compared Cape Cod Bay to the whaling grounds of the Arctic. If we had instruments and means to take them, we might have made a very rich return, the pilgrims later wrote, but for the time being, the whales were spared. Harpoons and nets were among the items they had failed to bring. When they tried to shoot one of the creatures from the deck, the gun exploded into pieces in its owner's hand. The blackfish might stand as a symbol of the strange new world that the pilgrims entered. It was an altered and vastly magnified version of what they knew in the old.
And it's the surprising history of what the pilgrims left behind in their old world and how that continued to define them after their landing in Provincetown that Nick Bunker writes about in his new book, Making Haste from Babylon, The Mayflower Pilgrims and Their World. Nick Bunker, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hello.
Nick, it's a very beautiful passage, and I think one of the surprising things about it is you mention a man named Jones. That's Christopher Jones, the master of the Mayflower.
Absolutely.
And this may have well been his first voyage across the Atlantic.
Well, that's probably correct. Now, indeed, I did spend quite a lot of time investigating the career of Christopher Jones. He's emblematic of the development of maritime England during this particular period. He was a sea captain from Harwich on the east coast of England, and the career of Christopher Jones was typical in the sense that he was a man who had done very well indeed out of shipping woolen textiles from England across the Channel to France and also onto Spain, and by bringing back French red and Spanish white wine. And this was a very prosperous trade, and the trade of this kind had grown substantially in the 15 or 20 years before the Mayflower sailed. Question, therefore, is why did he sail off to America in 1620? And when you investigate this, you find that the problem was that there was a slump in the textile trade earlier in 1620. It was essentially caused by an economic depression that was creeping across the whole of Europe. So in the career of Christopher Jones, you see an example of how the Mayflower is kind of a point of intersection between a whole series of different historical trends and movements. It's part of religious history, it's part of political history, but it's also part of the maritime and economic history of England at the time.
Mm. And Nick Bunker, on that note, I mean, that's really sort of the treasure that's in your book, is all the previously undiscovered or unexamined information and records that are kept about the pilgrims in England, in those little seaside towns, as you said. So what is it that surprised you or should surprise us about that history that you uncovered in researching the book?
First question you have to answer is, why was it that it took so long for the English to become interested at all? We all know that Columbus sailed across the Atlantic in 1492, but it wasn't until the 1620s that the English established substantial, secure colonies north of Virginia.
And in the American narrative of that, it's the establishment of those colonies wasn't necessarily for economic purposes. I mean, we learn at a young age that it was for religious freedom.
Well, that's true, but religion has to be paid for. If you want to set up a colony 3,000 miles away and you want to supply yourself as you have to with gunpowder and lead from home, with shoes and all the other things you need, and if you want to pay down the debts that you've incurred in England in order to finance the passage in the first place, you have to have trade, you have to have commodities that you can send back. Now, this is something that was recognised back in the 17th century by the people of New England themselves, and there was not necessarily any conflict involved between being a Puritan or religious separatist on the one hand and being somebody who was an entrepreneur on the other. The two things really went together.
So paint the picture, if you could, of how the pilgrims occupied English society before they actually departed for the United States. Where were they economically? Where were they socially? What kind of people were they in England?
Well, let's imagine you have a village of maybe 200 or 300 souls. In that village, the vast bulk of the households would be tenant farmers or landless labourers. The typical separatist would be somebody who was probably the largest tenant farmer in the village. In other words, the typical pilgrim, if you like, would be somebody who was probably aspirational. They probably had been upwardly mobile in terms of accumulating more land and more wealth. But on the other hand, their lives were still pretty insecure because it was a society in which there was a huge gulf between rich and poor, and the gulf was getting wider. But I think that the passage to America, of course, offered them the scope and the capability to do far more, to conduct an experiment in local democracy, which was far more radical than anything they would have been able to achieve in England, mm-hmm. although such experiments had been going on.
So they weren't necessarily a ragged group of religious free thinkers. They were a little more refined than that. But what I find so interesting about that is, you're right here in Boston when they do archaeological surveys that unveil artifacts from this time, from the 17th century, you find very surprising objects that you usually wouldn't ascribe to pilgrim life. Yeah. I mean, they've uncovered the evidence of olive trade, very fine lace, yes. things like that. So, yeah. It does seem that these were people who were more worldly than we may have expected. It was beyond belt buckles and pilgrim hats.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the things I did in the book was to try to compare the life of one particular pilgrim in America, a man called Samuel Fuller, with the life that was lived by the rest of his family who had remained back in England. Samuel Fuller came from a place called Redenhall, which is a village in Norfolk in the eastern part of England. They rebuilt in America something not unlike what they'd had back home in Norfolk, but with considerably more prestige, with considerably more status. And of course, Samuel Fuller, having come from quite a modest background in England, in America, on the other hand, he could acquire the status of being a medical man. He was the surgeon and physician to the Plymouth colony. He had two houses, he had his own gun, he had livestock, and he enjoyed a degree of prestige which he couldn't have commanded at home. And it meant that although he didn't actually become a member of the landed gentry as such in the Plymouth colony, because that expression wasn't used, he was able to operate as an equal to men like John Winthrop, the governor of Massachusetts, which he couldn't have done if he were living back home in Norfolk.
Hmm. And if we fast forward a couple years, you say that it wasn't necessarily 1620 that we should think of as the birth of America, but rather a few years later, 1628. And this comes as, I have to admit, quite a blow to a Massachusetts ego. But it wasn't in Massachusetts that you say the pilgrims really got their best foothold, but it was actually up in Maine. Why is that?
Well, of course, actually, Maine was part of Massachusetts until the 19th century. So,
very true.
That's right. You see, they needed supplies of beaver skins because beaver fur was the only commodity which they could hope to sell in London at a price high enough to pay down the huge debts that they had incurred while they were putting the voyage together. The importance of 1628 is that that was when the pilgrims set up their trading post at a place called Cushnock, which is actually now right bang in the centre of Augusta, Maine. Because, of course, that gave them access to the eastern Abenaki people who were living up the Kennebec River and living on what is now the Canadian border, who were able to bring very large quantities of beaver fur down to Augusta.
Nick Bunker, if I can just ask you a final question here. Why is it that you decided to entitle your book Making Haste from Babylon?
Well, it's based on a quotation from a letter written by an English Puritan in the late 1620s. He was writing to a friend of his, John Winthrop, who later became the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Boston. And what this chap wrote was this: "Cruelty and blood is in our streets. The land aboundeth with murders, slaughters, incests, adulteries, whoredom, drunkenness, oppression, and pride. Even the least of these is enough, and enough to make haste out of Babylon." The reason I chose it as the title of the book was that I felt that the quotation expresses the kind of sense of urgency and almost of excitement about the process of emigration. And so that's why I felt that it was an appropriate title for the book.
Well, that's Nick Bunker. He's author of the new book, Making Haste from Babylon, The Mayflower Pilgrims and Their World. Nick Bunker, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Boston.
Well, thank you.
Nick Bunker will also be at the Harvard Bookstore tonight in Cambridge at 7 p.m. When we come back, if you're a rower, next time if you feel like grousing about rowing conditions on the Charles, imagine what it would be like to row in, say, Iraq. One Boston rowing coach knows exactly what I mean, and we'll hear his story. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.